Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Our culture seems almost steeped in infidelity, so much so that a jeweler recently ran ads in major magazines. He was showing an engagement ring, and the tag was, "Virtually eliminates cheating, since you'll never want to take it off." So I think it's enough to make one wonder, have we reached the point where staying true to our partner is more pipe dream than practical? Or has faithfulness reached an expiration date? Here to help us sort this out is Dr. Scott Holtzman. Welcome to this program, Dr. Scott.
Thank you so much for having me on, Diana. How are you?
I'm good. You and I have a bit of a history. It's very legitimate.
But not in the history together of infidelity, that is.
That's right. It's very legitimate.
Just to be clear.
That's what I'm about to be, because it's always good to be clear, isn't it? We find that out with our patients. Clarity is important. We met on the Berman Sister program, which was more than 10 years ago now, and Laura and Jennifer Berman. And then I think soon after that you were on my program in Hawaii, and so that was about 2002. So I'm delighted to have you back. In the interim, you have now written four books. And so today we're going to talk about the secrets of surviving infidelity, but as a distinguished fellow of this American Psychiatric Association, yes, dear listeners, we have a very well-known psychiatrist as a guest today, but you started out with the secrets of happily married men, the secrets of happily married women, the secrets of happy families, and now this book, and you've been featured on the Today program numerous times, and what other programs?
Well, I've been seen on a number of national shows. Good Morning America, 2020. Mm-hmm. I've been on interviewed by many of the important magazines, and most of this really started while I was doing my research as a faculty member at Brown University, and grew a passion for trying to understand marriage and what made marriage work. And it just occurred to me that there were so many people who had figured out how to make marriages work. You don't hear their stories, or you don't, you know, you hear the popular culture, you hear the quote-unquote experts on television telling you how to make a relationship work, but you very rarely hear from real people that have really struggled. So that's where I started my research, and that's where the first three books emerged from, My Secrets of Happily Married Men, and the next book was called The Secrets of Happily Married Women, and as you pointed out, the third book was Secrets of Happy Families, which really geared maybe a little bit less toward traditional, one husband, one wife, 2.6 kids, and a white picket fence, and really kind of expand the question of all kinds of relationships and including family relationships and how we can grow through them.
Yes. So you're right. We don't often hear about the really good marriages. And, of course, you covered that, I guess, in your first two books. I have read your most recent book. Your publicist very kindly sent it to me. And speaking of that book, The Secrets of Surviving Infidelity, Dr. Holtzman has agreed to give a copy away to the first caller. If you have a question, you are anonymous on this program. You need to call in 888-874-4888 and ask your question, and Melissa, our wonderful producer, will take your name and address so that you can receive his book. You'd be so, as Dr. John Gray put, he said this book will, Dr. Gray, the author of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, he said, taking time to read this book will change your life, because rebuilding trust after an affair is not easy, and it requires a special kind of support and clear guidance. And you really do, Dr. Scott. You show the way to so many. And it's a very readable book. It's just, I like your language. It's friendly, and people can relate to it, and you have a lot of examples from the web of real people writing to you and you answering them. It's a great book.
It was a challenge because mm-hmm. one of the things that I like to integrate into the writing that I do and the speaking that I do is humor. And
right.
It's not, it's, you know, there's not a whole lot of margin for having humor in this. So mm-hmm. certainly in terms of not taking ourselves too seriously, I'm a big advocate for that. But I think people will find if they've read my Happily Married Men book or Happily Married Women book that, you know, a little bit, this is a little bit more kind of, all right, let's sit down and talk.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, every once in a while, I can't help it. I talk, for instance, about one of the statistics in there, which I'm sure you appreciated given your own background in gerontology,
mm-hmm.
When you look at statistics about infidelity, that the highest rates are people that are in the age of 60 and older.
60 and older.
When I make a point of saying that, you know, when you hear this, you're probably thinking it's the generation of people that are walking around with necklaces yelling, you know, help, I've fallen and I can't get up. But not so. In my editor, thank goodness, let me keep that in there. But the point I make is look at people that are 60 and 70 right now. I mean, they're Mick Jagger. You know,
mm-hmm.
they're Janis Joplin. They're, I think we now have James Taylor moving into that category. So,
mm-hmm.
People of that age, their idea of fidelity looked a lot different than what it looked like in the generation before, the generation before that. And so much has changed since the 70s in terms of people's sense of commitment and marriage. And I try to integrate some of that historical information into very practical ideas on recovering infidelity and moving forward.
And you do give a lot of practical advice, and that's one reason I find your book so readable, and I know the listeners will as well. DrScott.com is your website, and they can learn more about you and your books there. So let's start where everybody likes to start. What's the definition of infidelity, the broad definition of it?
It's a good question to start off with because there's no obvious answer to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of us know that if you are engaged in a marital relationship, or your partner is, and one of you ends up having a sexual relationship with someone who was not part of that relationship,
mm-hmm.
and your partner did not know about it and did not sanction it, that's
mm-hmm.
infidelity. I think
mm-hmm.
almost everybody can agree on that.
Yes.
But what about sending somebody a text message that you might find romantically interesting and leaving it at that? You know, that's the range of
mm-hmm.
what people consider infidelity. And I think part of the issue is that it does depend in part on how each member of the couple defines it. So we look at things like emotional infidelity, things
mm-hmm.
like I spoke about, starting to get really involved with somebody, sending them text messages and emails. One person may end up having a correspondence with a high school sweetheart. Now they'll say, "I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything wrong." But if their partner believes that it may be crossing the line, then I think they have to pay attention to that. Here's the one thing that I would caution your listeners to use as a litmus test. If you're engaged in some type of relationship with someone for whom you have a sexual attraction or a potential sexual attraction,
mm-hmm.
and you're keeping that information from your spouse,
keeping it a secret,
or somebody that's in a long-term relationship, you're in a long-term committed relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not keeping that, well, you see, you use the word secret, but some people will say, well, I didn't keep it a secret, I just didn't, it just didn't happen to come up. You know,
mm-hmm.
I didn't happen to mention that for the last month I've been corresponding with my high school sweetheart. I didn't keep it a secret. Come on.
But it's a lie by omission.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So if you're having that kind of even non-sexual relationship with someone, you ought to be sharing it with your spouse. And that even goes for the workplace. So if I'm sitting down and there's a really interesting, potentially attractive person at my workplace that I really like, and I'm having a great conversation, I make sure I go home that night and say, hey, there's somebody great at work, and I had a great conversation with her. I'd like you to meet her sometime. Now, it doesn't mean my wife's happy about it. What do you mean? You know, I'm not necessarily my wife. She's already been married to me long enough that I don't think she'd be too upset. But I mean, a partner or a spouse might not like the idea that you talk about that. But you're saying, I'm not keeping anything secrets, and that's really the first step toward recognizing when you've crossed the line.
I agree, and I will counsel some of my patients that if a man feels like he's crossed the line, that it would be a good idea to face his spouse and admit to her that something's wrong and say, you know, I'm looking around and I shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
And then figure out with her what you can do to make your relationship, your marriage, better. And then once you know what's wrong and how you'll fix it, saving your marriage will replace thoughts of cheating, perhaps. but facing up to it.
And, you know, it's interesting because there's a certain level of maturity that we therapists assume that people in relationships have.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it would be great if everybody could say, I'm starting to feel this way, let's use it as a forum for discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But often
mm-hmm.
people react to that like, well, what do you mean, and what's the matter with you, and what's the matter with me? And the communication starts to break down. It's
mm-hmm.
so important for people to stay open-minded.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying open-minded in terms of we should be able to have sex with whoever we want.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean
mm-hmm.
open-minded in terms of not judging our spouse. You know, if they want to come out and say, look, you know, there's some stuff going on I need to talk about, that's an invitation. That's a gift. And it certainly shouldn't be, your partner shouldn't turn around and use it as a means to attack you.
A weapon.
As a weapon, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So what's so interesting is that there is a gender difference about why men cheat and why women cheat. And I'd like to start, because you address this very well in your book, The Secrets of Surviving Infidelity. So let's start with why men cheat, because there really are differences.
There are differences, but mm-hmm. and I want to caution listeners that when I talk
yeah.
about these differences, they're in
mm-hmm.
broad generalities.
Of course.
It doesn't apply to every man and
mm-hmm.
every woman.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people may listen and go, "Oh, that's not me at all."
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are some differences.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but one of the inarguable difference about men is they have more testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
They have about 10 times more testosterone than women.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if you do surveys, just casual surveys, for instance, when you'll say to a college student, you're going on a date and you're meeting somebody at a bar, what do you think the likelihood is you'll have sex with them, and how much would you like that to happen? The vast majority of men will say, well, of course it's going to lead to sex. That's what I want.
Mm-hmm.
And if you
mm-hmm.
ask that exact same scenario to women,
mm-hmm.
A much smaller percentage. They'll be like, well, sex? No, I just want to meet someone. I want to have fun. I want to flirt. I don't want to have sex.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
some of this may be cultural. I understand
mm-hmm.
that. Some of
yeah.
it, I think, is driven by pure chemistry. So studies are looking at and raising the question, and it's not been answered for sure, but that men may be more inclined to look for someone who will make them feel like they're powerful, who will make them
mm-hmm.
Feel like they're smart.
Mm-hmm.
They're much more likely to want to engage in sex, and they're more likely to be hurt if a woman has an affair and actually it goes on to sex. Wait,
Dr. Scott. A lot of
yeah.
people don't realize that. Well, that the man is likely to be hurt if a woman has an affair and goes on to sex. Is that what you were saying? Maybe.
Yeah. That men are more likely to say, well, you know, all right, I know that you were texting him, you know, for the last month and that you were talking about personal things, but I draw the line at the fact that you had sex with him. The reverse, again, this is, there are researchers that will debate this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that the reverse we believe is true of women, where they tend to be more hurt if there was an emotional connection.
Exactly.
So, okay, I know you had sex, but you know you're just a stupid guy. I don't expect much more from you than that. But what do you mean you bought her a gift? What do you
mm-hmm.
mean
mm-hmm.
you want to meet her family? That you care about her? I can't believe you would do this to me. So there are some gender differences, and the bottom line is that each party, I think, has specific ways in which they may be hurt. And the take-home message for your listeners is that what's important is your specific partner and being sensitive to where that person draws the line.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just make one other point here, though.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the things that I write in my book is that the person that has a stricter definition of infidelity trumps the other person. So, for instance,
yes. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I say, well, I don't have a problem, or let's say, you know, my patient says, I don't have a problem if Barbara texts people and gets emails with their body parts. That doesn't bother me at all. And Barbara says, well, it bothers me when Jim gets text messages that are suggestive from women.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is that just because Jim says it's okay for Barbara to have lewd text messages doesn't mean it's okay for him just because he gives permission. She's got the stricter definition he has to apply to it. You know, he has to assume. But there are people that go too far, and that's the point. See, therapists often are unwilling to step in and say, you're right, you're wrong. But if I have a patient who says, look, I refuse to allow my husband... Again, this is not based on religion. I know there's some religious doctrines in certain people. But my own personal taste is that if my husband reads Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition, he's having an affair. I mean, at that point, it's like, well, maybe, but you know what? I don't think it's fair to set that expectation up for him. You know,
if
my husband opens up an email that has, you know, from a friend and it has a crude off-color joke, that's the same as having an affair. So while the person with a stricter definition usually trumps the other, I don't have people run to therapy. That's why I write my books. You can avoid
mm-hmm.
the therapist.
Mm-hmm.
But if you guys can't agree about the strict definition of an affair, ask a third party.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's so important, because then the third party, the therapist, can often help the couple step back and look at this with a new perspective, and see maybe all sides instead of getting all emotionally tangled up.
Yes.
So would you agree that for women, infidelity is thought to be driven more by emotional needs, that they somehow are not feeling attended to enough?
That's right. I mean, the classic scenario
mm-hmm.
for, although men often will say they have sex because they don't feel attended to. So
mm-hmm.
in some ways,
mm-hmm.
it's just a matter of what your relationship needs for attention. I often joke, although I think there's a grain of truth to the joke, that men very typically end up having affairs with their secretaries.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's somebody that treats him as if his ideas are brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
She's there when she needs him. If she says, would you mind getting me a cup of coffee? She says, what would you like in it?
Right.
You know, whereas if he says to his spouse, honey, would you get me a cup of coffee? She knows, you know where the coffee pot is.
Sometimes I give my patients, homework assignments, home play assignments. If they're sexual, I'll get one night for her to play a geisha, and she gets to do whatever he wants her to do. And sometimes I think that can play out in the rest, beyond the bedroom,
uh-huh.
where a woman can just do that. Serve her man for a bit. It doesn't mean she's forever his servant, but to try that role on.
Yeah.
And he might really like it a lot.
And she might really enjoy doing it. It's kind of like, okay, I don't have to think too hard. You know, just for the day, I'll kind of,
right.
We'll play this role. And, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, really, it's probably easier in a relationship to just get your partner a cup of coffee when he asks, particularly if it's not every 5 minutes, than to stir up a lot of negativity and hostility and anger, and then, you know, nobody's even enjoying their cup of coffee anymore.
Yeah, now, and we also know that from a behavioral point of view, behavior therapy, that a series of positive behaviors, getting coffee, fluffing your partner's pillow, rubbing your partner's feet, whatever, all of these positive behaviors done in succession will often lead to an attitude change.
Oh, absolutely. And that's really that's the basis of the secrets of happily married men and the secrets of happily married
mm-hmm,
women.
Mm-hmm.
It's just doing these behaviors. And of course, the famous researcher John Gottman, many of us
right.
quote his research all over, talks about the 5-to-1 ratio of mm-hmm. positive interactions, positive dynamic, positive listening versus the negative.
Mm-hmm.
It can be anything from put-downs to ignoring your partner. So you need to inject your relationship with a lot of positives. Now, what would a positive be for a woman? Well, I'll put you on the spot here, because now I've already said that for men, mm-hmm. the ideal affair mate and the kind of classic affair mate is their secretary. Do you want to try to guess what the classic affair mate is for a woman?
Let's see. For a woman, it might be a former high school boyfriend that maybe she's uncovered through Facebook.
Okay, sure, you've got that. But the casual affair that nobody expected to happen
yes.
is often with the contractor.
Oh, of course. You know, and I've had cases like that. Where the contractor,
the
no, that's such a good point, Scott, because the contractor is there and he's at her bidding and
exactly.
he's a masculine.
He is the equivalent of a secretary.
Yeah.
He's finally
yeah.
just someone in the household changing the light bulbs. That's all I
right.
need. Someone
right.
that is listening to me, not making me feel like I'm the smartest or best person, but
yeah.
making me feel like my opinions matter. He hears me. He's listening to me.
Uh-huh.
He's paid to listen to you, and he does things. And the other is the physical trainer, you know, personal trainer.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. So these are two examples of somebody that's attending to the woman, that's making
yeah.
really paying attention to her needs, putting a total focus on her. But there's a message for men there. That's what you need to do to keep your relationship going, is make you, you know, listen to your woman, change the light bulbs, you know, attend to what her needs are, and make her feel, you know, make her feel like she is a top priority.
I think it also helps if a man is really handy, if he's skilled. Because that sort of comes under the heading of a man protecting her.
Absolutely.
Because we females are wired to want to be protected. And I know that my own father, and he was such a great guy, so loving and fun and funny, but he also could fix anything. He could fix a car. He could do plumbing. And so I was drawn to that in a former husband and now my current mate, you know, just that it represents a strong man who's smart and can rescue me at times when I have some stupid kinds of failings about either my computer or electricity or something.
So there's a certain percentage of people that are listening to you right now thinking, oh my God, I'm doomed, of men. But, you know, there is a rider on that.
Yes, let's
say,
talk about that.
If you're not one of those people, then you have to be willing to snap, you know, you have to be willing to hire one of those people
yes.
to come in and take the initiative. Oh, honey,
right.
your computer's not working. I'm going to take that to the computer store right now.
Exactly.
I'm going to call the computer repair person. I'm going across the street to Jim, our neighbor, and I'm going to ask him to fix this.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to know how to do all those things, but you have to be willing to take those actions.
Yes, I'm so glad you made that distinction, because that's right. A lot of men aren't so handy, and they're not doomed. But the bigger point is that, and I liked what you said about you attend to your woman, you focus on her needs, and generosity like that certainly breeds reciprocity. I mean, it needs to come back, and
yeah.
I have found that my healthiest couples usually are fairly egalitarian in their relationship dynamic.
Well, they don't, you know, my really healthiest couples don't pay, they just feel like each is doing the best they can do.
Yeah.
So it's not egalitarian in the sense that I'm fixing the computer this week, you're going to fix the computer next week.
Yeah, it's not scorekeeping.
It's just we're bringing our best talents to the table, and we're not holding back.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that so much. I'm sure you help so many people, and that's one reason that you're still doing your work, because it's satisfying, and you're
it is.
And
I
you're
hear from people
yeah
all the time. It's uplifting to hear people and their stories and people who've recovered from infidelity and have found that there is hope out there. That just keeps me going.
Yes, of course. And you also talk quite a lot in your book about brain stuff, the dopamine and the oxytocin, and I think that's all fascinating. And we seem to, well, we know more about all the brain neurochemicals now than we used to because of what functional MRIs that came to the forefront in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
We have learned more about brains. Let's talk a little bit about some of that. The dopamine and the testosterone and receptors for vasopressin. Am I pronouncing that right? Or vasopressin?
You know what? You can pronounce it either way.
Okay, that's what I thought. And so, I mean, there's some research that shows that the fewer receptors for vasopressin, and this is a neurotransmitter associated with feelings of attachment and the need to protect a partner, then a man has in his brain, the more likely he is to seek sexual variety.
Yes.
And to be disloyal. And then I know the famous studies of the prairie voles versus the mountain voles.
So these are all really address the question,
mm-hmm.
which I think a lot of people ask.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually very common that people will say, well, is monogamy natural? I mean, we're talking about monogamy, we're talking about staying in a relationship with one person, but are we even designed to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where a lot of this research about vasopressin and oxytocin comes in, because we know that when you have receptors for oxytocin and vasopressin, you tend to bond better, and you even tend to bond for life. And when you block those receptors, you block the connection. Oxytocin is secreted much more in women than in men.
Yes.
It's, as you know, it's secreted in higher rates for men when they have orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the reasons that men will feel connected to women they have sex with. Besides all the emotional reasons, there's actually a chemical imprinting that takes place. So are we designed for monogamy? Now, you know, the sad truth is that only a very small percentage of mammals and vertebrae are monogamous.
Mm-hmm.
So there is maybe about 5%. Many of them are birds. There's only one other primate that sticks with one partner for life, and that's the gibbon. So statistically speaking, maybe we're not meant for one partner.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's arguments in either direction. You know, I dedicate a whole chapter to talking about some of that. But I think I think there's a lot of community, interpersonal issues and family-related issues that argue in favor of staying with one partner for life. You know, I've been fortunate in that I have one wife, and she and I have been together. And I know that if I choose to leave the relationship and have sex with other people, it's highly unlikely she'll continue to stay with me. Sexual fidelity is one good way of making sure you have one partner for life. And one partner for life is awfully convenient when your kids have weddings, you know, when you have to decide on who's going to pay for college, or when you're going on a family vacation, or even when your kids start acting out, you know, you can be a unified team. And it just doesn't end when your kids turn 18. They need parents together to the extent possible throughout their lives. So you're doing a great community service to your children. And it's really, as people live their lives together, they develop a sense of closeness and connection that can't be replaced by a series of 10-year relationships. So I think there's a lot in whether or not we're biologically inclined to monogamy. I think we can choose to be monogamous, and I think the human species, the human race, is better off for it.
I agree with you, Dr. Scott. We need to go to our half past the hour break, and so please stay with us. And when we come back, Dr. Scott Holtzman and I will talk about flame addiction. He has a whole part of his book. I love this part. How does he define flame addiction? What is it, and how does it impact infidelity? So we'll talk about that, and if any of you want to call in and win his book, the number is 888-874-4888. We'll be right back. We're back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. So happy because Dr. Scott Holtzman, he's a psychiatrist, has written a number of books, and we're talking about his book, The Secrets of Surviving Infidelity. And he talks about flame addiction. And I guess I wanted to run this past you. The very makeup of the human brain, as we just touched on this a little bit before the break, contributes to affairs. And so, and you mentioned briefly in your book, anthropologist Helen Fisher. And so she has shown in her brain imaging studies that there are separate neural systems for sex drive, romantic love, and attachment. And they can operate independently. So you can feel deep attachment to a partner, but also feel intense romantic love for someone else, while also feeling desire for sex with other partners. It gets complicated, doesn't it?
And I think that we often fall into exactly that scenario when somebody is having an affair. They will tell you that I love my spouse passionately, and even to the point where they say, we're not even having relationship issues or problems right now, but I'm in love with someone different. So I think that's not an uncommon scenario.
So how do you talk, can you give a few more details about flame addiction
book? Yeah, people may not be familiar with the term flame addiction, and I think what happened from my point of view is I remember several years ago I was interviewed about Tiger Woods, and the question was, does he have a sex addiction? And I don't know. I mean, I never interviewed him. Didn't treat him, but it was really kind of a broader question about whether sex addiction exists, and I believe sex addiction may exist. People that simply have a desire to engage in sex, to have orgasm, to experience sexual pleasure, and need to keep upping the ante. That's out there. But I think what's important for people to recognize is that is not the reason that most people have affairs. It's not for sex addiction, and many people, the first few months or even years of their affair may not even have included sex at all. So what is it? What is it that drives that person to find somebody outside the marriage and to keep that relationship going? So if it's not sex, what is it that they're drawn to? And that's where I came up with the term flame. Mm-hmm. Now, when I think of a flame, it's kind of a double meaning. On one hand, a feeling you have for someone is a flame, so that I have a flame for Gwyneth Paltrow.
And remember the old song, My Old Flame. I can't sing very well.
I have to say, I have not heard of that song.
Oh, yeah. It's probably from the 30s or 40s. But it's called My Old Flame.
Yeah. Well, sure. And then there's something. So the flame is a person that's outside, that is your flame, my old flame. And a flame is something you feel on the inside, like a fire burning.
Right.
So,
right.
And of course, the analogy of the moth circling the flame is really, as a matter of fact, one of the things I was talking about with my publisher. And I love the cover of my book, but I also was kind of pushing maybe you can have a picture of a candle and a moth circling around.
Right.
Because, again, it's the draw of the flame. It's so appealing. It just draws you in. And, of course, it's going to only lead to destruction.
Mm-hmm.
So when I describe flame addiction, it's different than sex addiction because it's that draw to a flame, the passion of feeling really special around someone. And that's where I mention the research by Helen Fisher, the anthropologist, the look into the different hormones, because the flame part of your of an affair, the flame addiction part, is really the same thing that happens in just about anyone that's experiencing an infatuation.
Infatuation, yes.
That's triggered by a number of hormones in the brain, or I should say, brain chemicals.
Yeah.
So the one brain chemical is a surge in norepinephrine noradrenaline, which is like adrenaline. So it's the thing that gets your heart racing and gives you that little bit of a thrill.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a pump up and there's an increase in the amount of dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
Dopamine is the chemical that's associated with what we call the reward mechanism, or so we think of it as things like cocaine addiction and heroin addiction. When they see even pictures of it or see the word cocaine or see powder, they'll start to get a kind of rush. That's dopamine. And both of those are very important in the addiction system. And then the third component is a brain chemical called serotonin.
Mm-hmm.
And serotonin, while we think of it as a feel-good hormone, it's actually an anti-anxiety hormone. And what researchers have found is that when you're really infatuated with someone, your serotonin levels go down. You actually have a serotonin depletion.
Mm-hmm.
And serotonin depletions leave people feeling cravings. They leave people feeling obsessions. And nothing makes you feel good. And you know that feeling, like when you started to date somebody and you're sitting by the phone. Of course, these days you don't sit by the phone. You carry it with you. But you wonder whether they're going to call and whether they're going to text. And you're about to go on a date and you prepare. It's oh, my God, I can't wait. I'm just so nervous. What if I say something wrong? What if he doesn't show up? What if she doesn't like me? And that's the feeling, the low serotonin that happens. And it's a perfect setup. Again, when you're dating and you're not married to someone, it's a great way to start a relationship, having this kind of flame addiction. But it's healthy in that point because it's not, it's one of the steps that are necessary for a long-term relationship with someone. But when you are already in a committed relationship and you start to have these same things trigger and happen, it is a problem. And that's why we call it the flame addiction.
Just to back up, because some of our listeners are single, and I think this is an important point that many women, for example, who are on antidepressants when they fall in love, they're on the SSRIs, right? So their serotonin
things
is
like Prozac, Zoloft, Lexapro, those.
So
things.
They don't have that obsessiveness and the cravings. And so their falling in love is altered a little bit.
That's right. No, we don't know that because we haven't looked at studies specifically that address that. But it's a good guess that the mechanisms of infatuation do change when you are taking these medicines, which could be good in a way because, you're not just... You're not just ending up being attracted to every moron that happens to wink at you.
Yes.
But it could be bad in a way, too, because if you don't realize that your antidepressants are interfering with this, you know, intensity of feeling,
mm-hmm.
you may turn around and say, you know, this is not the right one. I don't have the right chemistry.
Exactly.
I'm not having the fluttering in my heart. And it could be that you're medicating that fluttering away, and he's perfectly, or she's perfectly well, the one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, oh, modern life has made everything more tricky, hasn't it?
It
more
has.
Complicated.
And now, you know, now we're with internet dating, you know, you have so many different people that you can meet chronically, and you know, day in and day out, you've got dozens of possible people to be attracted to. So those things also make these kind of emotional connections much more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I think stimulates that sense of attraction and connection with infidelity is the fact that it's forbidden. It's secret.
Yeah, talk more about that. That's a very important part of this, isn't it?
Sure.
The taboo factor.
Yes, and just the very fact that you are doing this in secret makes it more exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So you tend to have more dopamine and more epinephrine surge, and so
mm-hmm.
you tend to kind of view it as proof that you really feel strongly connected to this person.
Yeah.
That is part of the appeal for people, is sometimes this sense of mystery, and when it's all, and often you'll hear stories about when it all comes out into the open, then it just becomes any other relationship.
Now
I've not found the original study that reflects this. Although I've heard Frank Pittman, the late Frank Pittman, quoted as saying that only 1 in 7 of relationships that, or marriages that form based on an affair.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I'm having an affair with somebody, I divorce my partner, I marry that person. Only 1 in 7 of those relationships end up succeeding.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. I wish I could find the original research that tells me that, though. So I'm only telling you that I read it as research that somebody else published. I haven't just seen it myself.
Yeah. Well, maybe one of our listeners will write to you via drscott.com.
Absolutely. Let me know
and help you with that, because
is.
I remember in the early days of my work, because I've been doing this work for 32 years, reading Dr. Frank Pittman, and
mm-hmm.
yeah, you said the late. I figured he died, because I haven't read much about him lately.
He hasn't published much. He passed away just around the time my Secrets of Surviving Infidelity book came out about a year ago.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful guy that wrote a few books like Private Lies, and he also wrote a very positive book for men. He was very much a men's advocate and was one of my mentors.
Yes. I think one of the articles that I read...
Grow Up was the other book that he wrote.
I think one of the articles I read by him was How to Get Your Man into Therapy.
Sure, that would be exactly. And the thing is, the short answer for that is you got to find a therapist that's not going to treat him like a woman. And it's hard to do that these days.
Oh, that's fascinating. Say a little more about that, Dr. Scott.
Well, the therapist's office is really set up as a place that's perfect for women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got your... Impressionist paintings on the wall. You've got the right. You've got the low volume, the lighting in the damask, you know, covers on the couches. But look at what it looks like if you go to a steakhouse, you know, or a gentleman's club. I mean, there's leather seating. There's bold paintings. It's brightly lit because men have more difficulty seeing in low-lit areas. So they feel somewhat more on guard when they're in that environment.
Mm.
And then when you get in that environment, you're basically told, okay, the way to heal is by talking. Well, when in a man's life has been the way to solve problems by talking? You know, so you set up an environment...
Counterintuitive for the man, isn't it?
Well, exactly. And then you could say, that's you just have to learn how to do this. But I think somebody that's more action-oriented, that more is like into coaching,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that is willing to share their own experiences within mm-hmm. limits mm-hmm. instead of just nodding your head and saying, that must be difficult for you. You know, you really want to find a therapist that's going to make a man feel like he can be competent and still be a man instead of trying to convert a man into a woman in order to have better relationships. So, if Frank wrote that article, God bless him, and I know that that would be one of his points, is that, mm-hmm. you know, we have feminized therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So we've made
mm-hmm.
men feel inadequate, and then when you go to couples therapy, then women turn around to the men and say, well, I thought you said you'd do anything. This clearly isn't working. You're not trying hard enough. But maybe it's not set up for a man to succeed.
Oh, you have such wise words, and it's, I think I would like to think that intuitively I make it very comfortable for both genders, to be neutral and to really listen to both sides. And
well, one thing you do is, of course, you really advocate for the power of sexuality, which
I do.
You know, if you ask men what their main complaint is in relationships, men's first complaint is that they don't seem to be able to get anything right. That the message their wives often give them is you can't get anything right.
Mm-hmm.
But the second complaint when they finally kind of bury that one is that they're not having enough sex in the relationship.
That's right.
So
and
you know that a man mm-hmm. is going to feel positive toward you because you're saying sex is important. As opposed to many therapists that will say talk is important. And when you've done enough talk, then you'll feel like having sex.
Yes, that's very true. And that's precisely why many couples will come to me, because I am a board-certified sex therapist and also a licensed marriage and family therapist, but they like it. They know if they come to me, I'm going to be a cheerleader for sex. So they're much
more... Let me just be clear. When you said that's very true, you're saying that my comment is true, not that... Once you learn how to talk and communicate, then sex will automatically get better.
Oh, right. Your comment is true. Thank you for clarifying that. You're such a good psychiatrist. Yes.
Right. So that you don't endorse the idea, let's just talk about our problems and then we'll have great sex.
Absolutely not. And I even am an advocate for depending on the couple's issues. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, let's jumpstart the sexual relationship.
Absolutely. Yeah. If
and
you want to
and,
hold
and
off,
for,
right.
for lots of women... arousal precedes desire.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got to start to get into it.
Yes.
And when they do, then they'll start to feel desire, particularly perimenopausal women, menopausal women, whose the hormones are off and so on. So, yes.
Yes, and this, Diana, is why men feel comfortable mm-hmm. in your office, because
yes.
this is a conversation you're willing to engage in.
Yes.
So,
I think that's true. Yes.
So just moving forward on flame addiction, because I know there may be some other things you want to talk about. I do kind of have a modified 12-step program that goes along with it. I think
please talk
you
about
need,
that.
You need to just like in just in sobriety, you need to abstain from the thing which is your drug of choice. You need to take it one day at a time.
Mm-hmm.
It just may be too much for you to think, I'll never see this person again. So you say, look, I just have to make it through the day.
Mm-hmm.
It's imperative that just like AA gives people social support,
mm-hmm.
You can get support either professionally or spiritually or from family members. Now, you don't want to tell everybody in your life that you were having an affair. You know, you don't want to post it on Facebook. But a few close friends can sometimes be very helpful in sorting this out, whether or not you've been the victim of an infidelity or whether you've engaged in it yourself. So those are, I think, some things to keep in mind. You know, people need to have patience. I've heard many stories of people that just jump into, that's it, I'm filing for divorce. You cross the line. Now, I get it if you cross the line a dozen times. But people, it takes a while to recover from infidelity, and unfortunately people will slip. You know, you'll swear, I'll never send her another email, and then the next thing you know, you're doing it. There are going to be setbacks. And you know, as I talk about that, can I just jump ahead to an area in the book in which I talk about recovering from the affair?
But before you do that, I want to tell our listeners that fortunately, Dr. Scott has agreed to return to this program for part two, which will be May 6th. So I was thinking, Scott, that I want you to talk about recovery, but we'll especially focus on, oh, how to apologize and how do you recover, and I'd like to look at how couples can cheat-proof their unions, and then how do you start over? How do you rebuild? Because I've certainly worked with couples, and I know you've worked with lots of them, who rebuild a marriage after an affair, and it's stronger than ever.
So you're just teasing your listeners.
I'm teasing the listeners, but I want you to talk about, we have to stop at about 2 to 3 minutes before the top of the next hour. So, but do say some words. Let's tease them further about recovery.
Right. I want to, when we talk about this recovery issue, I want to be able to say, if I'm asking people to go through the steps, what do those steps involve? And there, I think we'll get a chance to talk about a lot of the emotions and a lot of the evolution and the experience once the affair ends. Mm-hmm. But let's just talk about that moment in which an affair is uncovered.
Mm-hmm.
And you as a partner need to make the decision about what to do next, both as somebody whose partner has cheated on you and someone who has cheated on a partner. So, I mean, obviously at one point you say, all right, well, I have, here you go, I just found out through a friend of a friend that you were, had an affair, or you were connecting with, or you had some inappropriate interactions with our neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you do from there? Now, the most common reaction that somebody has when they're accused of infidelity is, mm-hmm. I know this is going to shock you, is to deny it.
Doesn't shock me, but I...
Right. I mean,
didn't Freud say the most common defense mechanism was denial?
Denial. Well,
yeah.
see, people will still say to me, Dr. Olson, what's the best way to find out if someone's having an affair or not? And I'll say, well, the best way to not find out is to ask your partner. Because they'll almost always say, I'm not having an affair.
Right.
And my experience has been that, and there are reasons, you know, that mm-hmm. people don't reveal it. I mean, you and I are kind of laughing, we're sounding callous, but often, you know, people, you know, they either have embarrassment about it, or they want to spare their spouse the pain.
Mm-hmm.
They're conflicted, they don't know what to do, or they may not have actually even honestly thought it was an affair, because they thought mm-hmm. what they were doing was within bounds. So there may be reasons that people deny, but my own experience is that people will generally only admit to what a partner already knows.
Yes.
So you know, the idea is this, well, you're texting somebody. No, I'm not. Oh, but I looked at your phone, and I see texts from that person. Okay, but we only texted once. See here. Oh, but wait a minute. I called the service provider
mm-hmm.
For the phone company, and they said you've interacted 500 times.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, it was 500 times, but it was not anything other than business. Well, wait a minute. I have, you go from there. I have the information it says that you were talking about. And it really will go on until you have to uncover it.
Mm-hmm.
And it sets up this dynamic
mm-hmm.
between the person who had an affair becomes like the Inquisition,
mm-hmm.
or the person that was cheated on, and actually fuels this kind of paranoia and rage. What a terrible path to go through. So
terrible.
Ultimately, at a certain point, if you're going to make the decision that it's time to talk about the affair, these are the four rules that I basically put out there, and the four steps. The first is that you have to break off the affair.
Mm-hmm.
You have to end the affair. And you may say that makes common sense, but I can tell you there are some well-respected books in the academic community that say, well, we really can't tell patients whether to end the affair or not. Well, maybe you can't tell patients to end the affair, but you certainly can't save a marriage if there's still an affair going on.
Well, and what I say is I can't work with you unless you've agreed to end the affair.
There you go.
Yeah.
Right. So, because it just, the competition is,
mm-hmm.
you can't win. It's this
mm-hmm.
perfect person out there that you have no conflict with.
Mm-hmm.
So the step one is to break off the affair. And mm-hmm. you know, you need to be absolutely clear. And women in particular are bad at doing this. But you know what? I'll throw in men into the fray too. They'll say things like, "I think it's a good idea if we never talk again," or "It's probably better off if we don't talk," or "This I think we should end it." In other words, that's not uh-huh. being clear.
No.
Can you hear what I'm doing? I'm saying
I think you have all these qualifiers.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then this person is shocked that the person they're having an affair with has contacted them again.
Mm.
And they'll say to themselves, "But I told them that we need to end it." No, you
mm-hmm.
didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You told them you thought that you might need to end it. You only opened up more of an invitation to talk about it more. So you need to be crystal clear. And you need to leave no open doors. And again, some people will, you know, one therapist who I have a lot of respect for will say to somebody, "Well, you have to agree not to contact this person for at least a year." But if it's too intolerable for you to think of never seeing them again, then at least agree to that. And my view is no. Because all that does mm-hmm. is just postpones it, and then you idealize that person even more. It's kind of like saying, "Okay, I have my heroin out there, but I'm not going to use it for another year." Well, then all you do is think about it.
This is powerful. I'm so glad you have agreed to come back, because there's so much more to talk about. But I'm going to have to interrupt the steps. And
No, that's all right. That's why people will listen next time.
I think so. May the 6th. So people, go to drscott.com, drscott.com, and tune in for part two, May the 6th. And Scott, thank you. This has been...
And that's May the 6th, 2014, because this is going to be archived. They may not know which May the 6th
it is. It is, 2014. It'll be archived. And thank you for being on my program. I think you are an articulate, fascinating, intuitive, brilliant man, and I'm just so pleased you were my guest today, Scott. Thank you.
Diana, thank you.